Today is Friday, July 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. In a Facebook interview, the United States' top coronavirus expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was blunt.
There really is no reason why we're having 40, 50, 60,000 other than the fact that we're not doing something correctly.
Plus, Australia issues new restrictions as cases of COVID-19 surge.
New South Wales, home to Sydney, said it was banning dancing, singing, and mingling at weddings.
And can the European Union agree on how to fund its economic recovery plan? We'll have those stories and more next. India officials fear the nation is unready to deal with a surge of coronavirus cases, which could overwhelm hospitals and test a feeble healthcare system. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that update and more from around the globe.
Local governments are frantically trying to squash outbreaks and keep their economies running as the pandemic spreads in the vast countryside. In Bangalore, a city that prides itself as the centre of Indian technology innovation, the government ordered a week-long lockdown that began Tuesday evening after the cases surged exponentially. A spokesman for the Harvard Global Health Institute says the acceleration in cases remains the main challenge for India in the coming days, adding that a vast majority of cases were still being missed. That follows Brazil's announcement on Thursday evening that the country had passed 2 million confirmed cases and 76,000 deaths. That's 1,000 fatalities a day on average since late May, on a gruesome plateau that has yet to tilt downward. Fresh COVID-19 spikes, even in places as far-flung as China's vast western region, are prompting worldwide moves to guard against the pandemic as the number of confirmed cases globally approaches 14 million. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In Australia, Victoria State announced a record daily increase of COVID-19 cases, and neighbouring New South Wales said it was putting in place new restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Reuters' Libby Hogan has the details.
As the number of new COVID-19 cases surged in Australia Friday, New South Wales, home to Sydney, said it was banning dancing, singing, and mingling at weddings. Funerals and places of worship will also be allowed no more than 100 people. And State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says venues must have 4 square metres of space per person.
For weddings and corporate events, the maximum number is 150. But again, completely seated, no dancing, no singing, no mingling.
Meanwhile, next door in Victoria State, a record increase of more than 400 cases on Friday. Health Minister Jenny Mikarkos said, quote, "We are in the fight of our lives." That increase came despite a partial lockdown for more than a week. Victorians have been urged to wear masks when outside. Previously, only those in the capital, Melbourne, were asked to cover their face. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said his government will provide any assistance needed, and he urged against panic.
We would not have expected to see the results of the lockdown measures put in place in Victoria as yet. And I made very clear earlier this week, as indeed the Premier has, that we would expect to see some rather concerning numbers for a while.
A month ago, Australia was widely seen as a global leader in fighting COVID-19. But security lapses in Victoria saw people returning from overseas spread the virus, now at 11,000 cases. The surge in COVID-19 cases dents any hopes of quick economic rebound in Australia and may dash hopes of a travel bubble with neighbour New Zealand set for September.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Now turning to the United States, which now has over 3.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and nearly 140,000 deaths attributed to it. That's according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. More than half of the states are now mandating masks to be worn in public. The list of retailers requiring them is also going up as well. The AP's Sagar Magani takes things from here.
Target, CVS, and Publix are now among national chains who will mandate customers wear masks, following Walmart, Best Buy, and others.
Masks are very important.
In a Facebook interview, Dr. Anthony Fauci said they're among the easy steps the nation can take to stem growing numbers of new confirmed cases each day.
There really is no reason why we're having 40, 50, 60,000 other than the fact that we're not doing something correctly.
Even as more governors and stores require masks, the White House says it will not issue a nationwide mandate.
The CDC guidelines remain the same today, recommended but not required.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Western governments have accused hackers believed to be part of a Russian intelligence unit of trying to steal valuable private information about a coronavirus vaccine on Thursday, calling out the Kremlin in an unusually detailed public warning to scientists and medical companies. Intelligence agencies in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada allege that the hacking group APT29, also known as Cozy Bear, is attacking academic and pharmaceutical research institutions involved in COVID-19 vaccine development. The group was blamed for American election interference 4 years ago. University of New Haven's national security professor Matthew Schmidt told the Associated Press the hacking attempt was another example that the Russian government is weak.
Under Vladimir Putin, the government has not built a robust society that can do broad-scale, high-level science. Russian science is behind not just the U.S. and U.K. and Europe. It's behind China. It's behind India. And Putin desperately wants to build that up.
Schmidt said Russian scientists are under pressure to deliver a coronavirus vaccine, and that recent claims that they were the first to come out with a working vaccine was disinformation from the Russian government.
The report that came out explicitly says that we don't think there was a major threat to the continuation of the vaccine research. We don't know if they took data. It's not in the report. But even if they took data, we didn't lose any, right? We still have it. We can still work on it.
In Russian media, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, rejected those accusations, saying that Russia has nothing to do with those attempts. The entire world knows about the mortal threat of COVID-19 that it can cause to our bodies. Less visible, but also dangerous, is the mental illness that living with the epidemic can either create or make worse. Psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and other therapists say that addressing the emotional challenges will be key to getting this frightening moment behind us. To find out more about the novel coronavirus and the dangers of ignoring mental illness related to it, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Yuval Yuria, a professor of medical psychology at the Columbia University Medical Center. He is also the director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Program at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Yuria also conducted research on epidemics and mental health in the United States and West Africa during the Ebola outbreak of 2016.
Mental health really has a strong role. The threat is not only with regard to how our body deals with coronavirus. The threat is really also whether we are affected by the fear associated with the virus and whether we have enough support from our communities and families. Whether we can trust our medical officers, politicians.
I know that mental health awareness and mental health treatment in some parts of Africa can sometimes lag behind the West.
Absolutely. I think the way some of the African countries treat mental health is a little bit outdated. I can tell you from my experience in Sierra Leone 6-7 years ago when I stayed there studying the impact of the Ebola epidemic, I was shocked to discover that in the entire Sierra Leone country, there is only one psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist was actually retired.
What do you suppose explains the shortage of mental health awareness and mental health treatment on the continent?
Part of it is because of the stigma. They don't speak about it. They try to hide it. They are ashamed. But really, there is no difference between physical health and mental health. You have fever, you treat the fever. If you are depressed, you have to treat the depression. It's as simple as that.
Treatment for mental health or any kind of therapy used to be stigmatized here in the States. I remember growing up in New York during the 60s and 70s, telling someone they needed a psychiatrist was an insult. Maybe it was the same for you growing up around the same time in Israel?
I remember those days, in my case, in the 70s and 80s, reaching out to mental health treatment, even in the context of war or terrorist event, was considered weakness. But it is not like that anymore. And I hope this will also be eventually the status in African countries where people will feel free to get help And mental health will be also recognized by the government as an important resource to have for the citizens.
And I know that here in New York, and I guess elsewhere, healthcare workers who should know better often have trouble asking for help during COVID and other times.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes we forget what they are going through, especially in such a stressful times like now, where we have tens of thousands of COVID patients going to the hospitals and overcrowded departments.
So busy.
Not only busy, but also exposed to a lot of death and exposed to families who were terrified by the fact that they cannot really be with their loved ones. And some of them died at the end of a very painful hospitalization. So those medical teams are going through really traumatic events, and medical teams all over the world should be taken very seriously at this point, whether it's in Africa or elsewhere.
That was Yuval Nehria, a professor of medical psychology at the Columbia University Medical Center and the director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Program at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. On Monday, we'll have a second part of their two-part discussion about COVID-19 and mental health in the United States and Africa. VOA also has continued and expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. That address is voanews.com. And still to come on today's program...
It started with an Instagram account named for its social media advocacy for women. Assault Police, which picked up 164,000 followers in less than 2 weeks. On it, about 100 women and girls claim to have been harassed, sexually assaulted, or raped by Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a former student at the prestigious American University in Cairo.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's well known that bees venture out to collect pollen from flowers and tree blossoms to provide food for members of their expansive colonies. But what happens when bumblebees have difficulty finding flowers or blooms on their target plants? A new Swiss-led study published in the journal Science suggests that when bumblebees find flowerless plants, they start to destructively munch on its leaves. According to the study, the way that the bumblebee nibbles on the leaves can cause their target plant or tree to bloom 2 weeks to a month earlier than usual. The relationship between flowering plants and bees are mutually beneficial. The bees need the pollen for food, and the plants need the bee pollinators in order to reproduce. It's no accident that plants bloom around the same time bees emerge from their winter hibernation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said a deal on the EU's economic recovery stimulus package was possible at a summit beginning in Brussels today.
So we are at the beginning of the summit now, and the stakes couldn't be higher. If we do it right, we can overcome this crisis stronger and emerge stronger from the crisis. All the necessary pieces are on the table, and a solution is possible. And the solution, that is what our people in Europe expect from us, because it's their jobs that are at stake. And the risk of the virus still persists, and the whole world is watching us, whether Europe is able to stand up united and to overcome this corona-related crisis strongly, with a convincing European budget, with Next Generation EU. We have the chance not only to overcome the crisis, but also to modernize our single market and our union, to bring forward the European Green Deal and the digitalization. And therefore, this day today is of utmost importance.
That was the goal at the onset of the meeting. So, how did they fare? And to get the answer, I spoke with journalist Catherine Field in Paris via WhatsApp.
If you'd asked me that question yesterday, I would have said possibly if it goes into Saturday and Sunday. there could be an agreement at the summit. But coming into the summit, a lot of the leaders were saying, giving very cautious responses, saying there's a lot of work to be done. So a lot of caution rather than optimism at this stage, Steve.
So what seems to be the holdup? Because, you know, as the world is dealing with the pandemic, the economy is on everyone's mind. So what are the sticking points?
The major sticking point is, first of all, that COVID recovery package. Now, that's worth about 750 billion euros. There we have a very clear division between Northern European nations and Southern European nations. The Northern Europeans say, we're going to be borrowing this money. We're putting our good name on the line. In return, we want to be able to see where that money is going to be spent. We also want to decide whether it's going to be a grant to these poorer countries or whether it's going to be a loan. Then you have this other seven-year budget for the EU, which they've got to agree as well. Now, that is about 1.1 trillion euros. That's a lot of money that's got to be spread out over the bloc in the next 7 years. There you have an east-west split. The countries in the west, for example, Germany, France, the Netherlands, they're saying that the countries in the east, Hungary, Poland, need to sign up to agreements on rule of law, good governance. They want also environmental targets. They want countries that are getting any of this funding to sign up to say they will abide by the Paris Climate Change Agreement. They will have in the paperwork that they will do that. So we're really seeing all these different parts of Europe suddenly falling back into their own stereotypes and saying, well, this is what we want and this is what our electorate wants. And at the end of the day, it's our electorate that pays the tax that we're handing over to you in cash.
So what's the next step? Because the economic worries aren't going away.
The economic worries are not going away. And we're looking at the bigger countries in the European Union, such as Italy, Spain, France, looking at their economies contracting by around 10% by the end of this year. They're really the leaders, the 27 leaders are going to have to come to some sort of agreement. If not this weekend, then they're going to have to come back in a couple of weekends' time to try and do this all over again. This is really uncharted waters for the EU. There's always a lot of give and take, and at the end of the day, they seem to come up with an agreement. But this particular summit, the figures are so high, getting it right now matters.
Catherine Field was speaking to me from Paris, France. Engorged with more heeby rains, China's Yangtze River is cresting again, bringing fears of further destruction. The seasonal floods that already have left 141 people dead or missing have grown in force since last month. State media say the rate of flow in the reservoir behind the Three Gorges Dam would hit a record for the year on Friday night. Flooding this month has forced evacuations of around 1.8 million people, mainly in southern China. Direct losses attributed to flooding are estimated at $7 billion. An advocacy group says internet access in a southwestern province of Iran has been disrupted as videos circulate on social media of protests. NetBlocks.org reported the disruption affecting Iran's oil-rich Khuzestan province late Thursday. The outrage coincided with videos being published online of protesters gathering in the city of Behbahan, about 570 kilometers southwest of Tehran. A local police chief was quoted in local media confirming the protest and that officers dispersed the demonstrators. Social media in Egypt is exploding with voices echoing the Me Too movement following the July 4th arrest of Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a former college student accused of raping or harassing as many as 100 women and girls. His arrest came after a barrage of Instagram posts making the allegations against him. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Hamada El Rassam in Cairo.
It started with an Instagram account named for its social media advocacy for women, Assault Police, which picked up 164,000 followers in less than 2 weeks. On it, about 100 women and girls claim to have been harassed, sexually assaulted, or raped by Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a former student at the prestigious American University in Cairo.
Most women are usually afraid to tell anyone. You don't know if you tell your family if you will be supported or not. Or you may be beaten or touched again by the man who assaulted you.
Egypt has long struggled with the problem of sexual harassment. A United Nations study found that nearly all Egyptian women say at some point they have been victims of some form of it. But the Zaki case has proven to be different. After the women and girls spoke up, the man was arrested, and prosecutors say he will be held as six alleged cases are investigated. Zaki's family has been mostly silent, but they did tell NBC News the charges are false and that this is an internet pylon. But more social media accounts keep popping up, with users posting accusations against other alleged sexual abusers in what some commentators are calling Egypt's Me Too movement.
What's important is that this proves social media can have a very big role if people participate. The reaction was swift. In 48 hours, they captured the accused.
Since the arrest, Egyptian lawmakers have adopted a bill that says victims' names must be withheld from public documents to protect them from threats after they make an accusation. This will encourage more victims to come forward, but there is a lot more to do, say lawyers.
There should be an independent department in a judiciary that only takes cases related to violence against women. And it should not only deal with rapes, but with other violence and harassment, including between married couples.
Prosecutors say Zaki has confessed to blackmailing women and girls, but at the same time denies all other charges. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada Al-Rassam in Cairo.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On June 24th, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is increasing its reward offer from $5 to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location in any country of the new leader of ISIS, Amir Mohammed Saeed Abdul Rahman Al-Mala. Al-Mala, also known as Haji Abdullah Abdul Amir Mohammed Saeed Salbi, and Abu Umar al-Turkmani, had been named as a specially designated global terrorist on March 17, 2020. The designation blocks U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with the terrorist leader and freezes all property and interests subject to U.S. jurisdiction. The new reward offer of up to $10 million is double the previous reward offer of up to $5 million announced in August of 2019, said Todd Brown, director of the Diplomatic Security Service.
Al-Mala succeeded Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as the leader of ISIS following Baghdadi's death during a U.S. military operation in October 2019. Al-Mala helped drive and justify the abduction, slaughter, and trafficking of Yazidi religious minorities in northwest Iraq, and he oversees the group's global operations.
Director Brown noted that the announcement demonstrates the United States' resolve to use all of its available tools to counter terrorism and to hold ISIS and its leaders accountable for their actions. As we work to ensure an enduring defeat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, we are determined to identify and find the group's leaders so that the global coalition to defeat ISIS and our partners on the ground in Iraq and Syria can continue to target ISIS remnants and thwart its global ambitions. The United States remains committed to the enduring defeat of ISIS, no matter who leads that depraved organization, said Ambassador Nathan Sales, coordinator of the State Department's Counterterrorism Bureau and principal advisor to the Secretary of State on international counterterrorism matters. As Al-Mala's predecessors have all learned the hard way, the United States and our partners will not hesitate to do what's necessary to protect our homelands, our people, and our interests. If you have information about Amir Mohammed Saeed Abdul Rahman Al-Mala, please contact the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net. email info@rewardsforjustice.net or regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States.